morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Monday, October 28, 2024. South Sudan's Minister of Health says she needs support to battle cholera outbreak.
Because of the volume of the water that we are going to get, we will expect like what we are expecting today. So my ministry, with all the technical expertise, including WHO and all our partners, we had already plotted a plan to make sure that when we have got such cases, we respond adequately.
And the family of a former humanitarian worker who was picked in Juba last week are asking the police to do more to locate their son.
It has really created a lot of trauma to me and my children. My children are crying, where's daddy, where's daddy? They wanted to talk to their dad. The dad is nowhere to be seen.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's Minister of Health, Yolanda Awel-Deng, says the influx of refugees from Sudan is posing health risks at the South Sudan border crossing points. Minister Yolanda declared an outbreak of cholera in Reng County of Upper Nile State. She says residents across South Sudan should exercise caution.
On the 8th of October, we receive reported suspected cases of what we now confirm is cholera in Guntao Primary Healthcare Center in Reng. That is Upper Nile State. And the suspected cases were mainly from the people who are crossing over from Sudan side. We collected the samples. They were tested here at our National Public Health Lab using culture. And out of the 33 samples up to date, 6 of those samples have been confirmed positive. And also, there is a community, a lot of community reporting of cholera that is going on. So until now, all those 6 individuals that were confirmed positive are treated and they are gone back to their homes.
Talk to us about any potential spread of this cholera. I mean, cholera is contagious and it's raining in South Sudan. Cross-border activities are ongoing. What are the potentials that this could spread to places like Malakal, densely populated?
Cholera, unfortunately, it is a waterborne disease. And right now, South Sudan is experiencing a high volume of flooding, especially in the northern belt and central belt of the country. And the conditions that breed some diseases like that are very high, because one of it is the congestion of the people at the border. As I mentioned, it is one of our busiest crossing point from Sudan to South Sudan. And then number two, we have got a huge volume of refugees and returnees that came due to the conflict of Sudan from last year. And then number three, our amenities, services in those areas are very limited. As you know, the government has responded. You know, from last year, the government of South Sudan has been responding, but the volume of people coming in is actually too much. And now we have got issues of the road that have been washed out. So before the government of South Sudan, with coordination, that is the coordination mechanism between the humanitarian affairs, the Minister of Health, and all the involved institution, we used to transport people on the road to ease the pressure. But due to the flooding, most of the roads are cut off. So, of course, yes, we have to take a lot of precautions. Like today, when I mentioned that we have to follow guidelines, you know, to prevent and guideline to take measures against cholera, as I mentioned today in the declaration.
Some of the guidelines are clear. Wash your hands, wash your vegetables, and eat hot food, which are pretty simple. Let's talk about the national response to prevent this from spreading across the country. Could you bring us up to speed on that front?
At the moment, if you remember very well, John Tanza, beginning of the year, around March, April, there was another declaration that I did on behalf of the Minister of Education when we had heat wave. And at that time, because we are the technical institution, we had already projected that because of the volume of the water that we are going to get, we will expect like what we are expecting today. So my ministry with all the technical expertise, including WHO and all our partners, we had already plotted a plan to make sure that when we have got such cases, we respond adequately. So about 2 weeks ago, I had already sent my team on the ground, you know, like the team from the Ministry of Health, the State Ministry of Health, combined with WHO, UNICEF, and everybody else involved in the response. And we sent them to this hotspot. And when I sent the team, we sent the team some of the resources, what we call RTDs, you know, that is diagnostic, you know, tools. We send them, then we also send a cholera kit. We also send some health necessities that are needed in that area. So at the moment I'm speaking with you, I have got team stationed on the ground. I have got a little bit of supplies on the ground, but more is needed because, as I mentioned, I'm experiencing high volume of people coming into the country with limited resources.
South Sudan government is struggling with its own financial issues, and partners who are on the ground are also experiencing issues with the donations. I mean, it sounds like this particular situation is happening at a time when resources are mega or very little to help the ministry respond effectively.
You know, John, what you have mentioned is very correct. And I want to say that South Sudan is not in isolation from the rest of the world. As you know very well, economically, the whole globe is struggling as we speak. You know, we are almost in the verge of economic recession because we just came out of the global pandemic, COVID-19. And in particular, South Sudan has been firefighting, you know, small outbreaks and big outbreak. You know, right now I'm also on the preparedness for Ebola because the neighboring countries are experiencing Ebola and Marburg outbreak. So of course there is donor fatigue. You know, of course there's economic fatigue everywhere. But having said that, it is a matter of us trying to see and reprogram to make sure that some priorities are taking over other priorities. And that why, like the Minister of Health, which is like the government support, we sat down and we saw that this particular area needed more help. So we have diverted some of the resources that were supposed to be done for prevention somewhere for to be taken to the response at the moment. So yes, you know, it is going to take collaborative approach from everybody, you know, to make sure that like we respond effectively.
Minister Yolanda, when people hear about cholera, there is panic. Malakali is closer to Reng than Juba. If you have a message you would like to deliver to the people in Malakal, what would that message be?
My message is not only to Malakal or to a Reng area. My message is to everybody across the country and most likely across Africa, because not long ago, Malawi was also experiencing cholera. Zambia was also experiencing cholera. Namibia was experiencing, you know, like the same type of disease because it is waterborne disease. So like my message is follow the guidelines. That's number one. Number two, cholera come from, you know, using contaminated water mainly, you know. So if you can follow simple guidelines, like by making sure that your home area is clean, your utilities that you use in the house, like the, you know, the dishes, the beddings, and all this kind of thing is clean, and making sure that, like, you know, human waste are exposed like appropriately, we will be able to contain it. So my message is not only to people in Malakal or to people in Upper Nile only, but it is to the whole of South Sudan.
That's South Sudan's Minister of Health, Yolanda Awel Deng. She spoke to me via WhatsApp from Juba earlier today. Still in Juba, the family of a former humanitarian worker, Moki Johnson, who disappeared last week, is urging South Sudan's government to help find loved ones. Johnson's wife says she has been to all police stations across Juba town looking for her husband. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Johnson's wife, who did not want to disclose her name for security reasons, says she made several calls to friends and relatives with hopes of finding her husband.
He left home at around 11:30 a.m. in the morning. He went to pick a check from one of the insurance company, whom they treat their clients. Then later on, they'll be paid through a check. At around 1, when I called him, he said actually he's already leaving the bank and coming home. I waited. He did not reach home. When I tried to call around 3:30 again, this is when I realized his phones were off. I keep calling the numbers until 9, when I realized the numbers were not going on.
Johnson's brother, who also requested anonymity, says the disappearance is still a shock to the family.
I thank God that people are all concerned about his disappearance, especially friends, relatives, the in-laws. Everybody is concerned. We were praying for his judge to know that he is in such a place, and the reason for his arrest is because of ABCD. But up to date, there is no any other information leading to his whereabouts.
The wife says she has opened the case of disappearance at Gudele police station and hopes police will search for her husband.
In the morning when I woke up, the only thing I had to move to one of the police station, and I reported the case. Since that day up to now, I've been moving all the places with the help of other people, their friends, relatives, but still up to now, we don't know where about my husband is. So it has really created a lot of trauma to me and my children. My children are crying, Where's daddy? They wanted to talk to their dad. The dad is nowhere to be seen.
Johnson runs a medical center in Yei after retiring from humanitarian work with a non-profit called IntraHealth. Nyika Joel is an activist in Yei. He says disappearance of Johnson is brought to the residents of Yei town.
When it's happening, it's a tragedy to us. It's a tragedy to Yei. It's a tragedy to people of South Sudan. Because a very important person who comes and then want to help us, then get disappeared, and then we are worried about the innovation of the business that he said. We are now doubting whether this business will go ahead. But our cry is how circumstances that he really have committed, that have offended one. We call that South Sudan a sovereign country. Muki should be abandoned and then brought to the book.
Kasara Kong, spokesperson for South Sudan Police Service, told this program that he needs more time to source information from the various police stations across the town. Since the independence of South Sudan, the International Committee Red Crescent and the South Sudan Red Cross say they have recorded approximately 11,000 cases of missing persons. In March, the former mayor of Juba town, Callisto Ladu, was forcefully plucked from his house by armed men who kept him for close to 6 months in unknown location. Ladu was later released by the country's National Security Service after concerted pressure from rights groups, churches, and community leaders. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we move to the United States. With about 2 weeks left for American voters to head to the polls, Kwame Ofori speaks to some South Sudanese here in the United States on how they feel about the U.S. elections and how it impacts them. The first guest is James Atomic, who is based in Baltimore area of Maryland State.
People are very excited, and I've seen sizable number of our folks are ready to go to the poll. There are a lot of each individuals have different preferences and reasons why they're going to the poll, because this depends on an individuals.
That's interesting. And do you feel the elections, you know, has any impact back home in South Sudan?
Absolutely, absolutely. That is the belief and hope that whoever would become the president will definitely be able to also have a very serious look at whatever is happening back in South Sudan. And that also is a hope of South Sudanese that there should be a kind of better relationship that is built with the United States for a lot of the goalposts to be moved forward.
And talking about things happening back home, is there any particular thing that you'd want whoever wins to take a look at in referring to situations happening back home?
There is a lot of certain things that I strongly believe that United States can help South Sudan to attain and achieve a very lasting peace whereby this political misunderstanding will be ironed out and United States have a better mechanism of addressing those issues.
And South Sudan wasn't able to conduct, you know, its planned elections for 2024, as we know. How does the U.S. elections, you know, make you feel considering South Sudanese couldn't experience their own elections this year?
People live by example. The United States is one of the biggest, largest, and the mother of the democracy. And of course, South Sudan will also look at the other way around that, okay, if there were reasons why those other elections that they have planned is not done, probably they are looking for a better avenue. With the election in the U.S., they might also look at this as a good example that they need to conduct similar kind of elections. And if there is any shortcoming that they need, I'm sure they will reach out to people in the United States and those who are concerned, particularly in guiding them in conducting very credible and meaningful election.
Okay, and if you could speak to either of the candidates directly, that's for the U.S. elections, what question would you ask them and why?
I will ask them that, can you please consider South Sudan as the newest, the youngest country on earth? Can you consider helping them to also attain the same vision that people in the United States have? Can you be able to help them directly in helping them actually in conducting election? I know there may be a lot of things that are missing for them to be able to hold election, and simply because they are lacking resources. And the United States, of course, have the capability. They can be able to do that if it means the election machines or conducting voter registration, the way how the election official judges can be able to do this thing. They will be able to train our folks, and people, of course, will be able to have something much better than what they expected. Emerging out from all the conflict, from all the ups and downs, political rivaling, this will put an end and put the country in the correct path. People from South Sudan also, they should not shy away. Of course, we live in a global community. If something is difficult, it's good also always to reach out to your friends. And the United States has always been friend to South Sudan. And this would be a golden opportunity and something good that the officials will be able to coordinate and work collectively for their personal interests and the interests of everybody in the region and the world at large.
That's James Tomic, former chairperson of the South Sudanese community. And he's currently serving as an election judge in the city of Baltimore in Maryland State. He spoke with my colleague Kwame Ofori from Baltimore this past hour. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, what is the impact of young voters on American elections? Find out more after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The youngest voters taking part in the U.S. presidential election are called Gen Z. They range in age from roughly 18 to 27 years old, from learning how to vote to soliciting support door-to-door. Many are embracing the civic process of voting. VOA's Laura Bowman has more.
Thank you, our first mock voter.
Student leaders at Montgomery College in Rockville, Maryland, recently set up a mock polling booth with sample ballots and invited election officials to conduct voter education. It's an effort to get students ready to vote in the November U.S. presidential election. Brittany Green is an organizer of the mock polling exercise.
Today's event was all about voter education and letting people see the polls, see what they were going to experience at the polls.
Participants like Akian Demong seem appreciative.
I just want to see how it feels like voting for the first time, because this is my first time voting for the actual presidential election. I want to see what is the procedure.
These young voters care about a range of issues.
Financial issues with the debt of the country. I don't really understand much of it, but if I look at it, it looks like a big number. I don't understand why it's that high.
So I would say climate change is important, reproductive rights.
I think for many people, America's role in the world is a very important issue, particularly for young voters.
In the U.S. presidential race between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Kamala Harris, most of the students we interviewed would not reveal who they'll be voting for. But the U.S. state of Maryland, a stronghold for Democrats, is expected to go for Harris. So we asked the head of the Georgia Young Republicans, Jacqueline Harn, what issues matter to her Republican peers. For many, she said, it's about the economy.
Between housing, between inflation with grocery prices and gas prices ever increasing, it's unaffordable to live and have a family right now.
And how should campaigns go about reaching young voters?
You're not going to reach a Gen Z voter by doing a phone bank and phone calling them because they probably have a spam blocker on their phone, or they're just not going to answer a number they don't know. Because we're the social media generation. Everything that we looked at is on social media. We did our news from social media.
Democratic social media influencer Harry Sisson agrees.
And I'd say primarily, maybe the main news app for young people is probably TikTok. That's my main platform. And, whatever reason that may be, I think it's mostly because it's digestible. A lot of these news segments that you see on TikTok are 30 to 60 seconds.
Meantime, in Herndon, Virginia, Kamala Harris supporter Camila Alfonso Mesa goes house to house trying to encourage people to vote for her candidate. They don't always open the door, but she keeps at it.
Hi, definitely hire supporters.
She says that Harris replacing President Joe Biden in the presidential race was invigorating for young Democrats.
I have seen a big shift in energy and enthusiasm since the vice president became the nominee.
Alfonso Mesa thinks the Gen Z voting bloc of over 40 million young people could make a real difference in the presidential election. Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Still on U.S. election, it's 8 more days before Americans go to the polls to elect a new president on November 5th. Republican Party candidate Donald Trump and Democratic Party candidate Kamala Harris both have varying foreign policies. Trump will pursue an America First policy, while Harris will continue building alliances. Joseph Kioko is a Kenyan political analyst. He tells VOA's James Batty, while U.S. foreign policy is institutional, whoever wins the November elections will have to pay more attention to China's penetration into many African countries, including South Sudan.
American foreign policy is institution-based. It is not personal. And whoever comes in, most likely there'll be a continuation of the foreign policy that has been carried on by Biden. There'll be no drastic change. Of course, they'll want to address the question of China's penetration and the role China is doing in Africa, being that China has one-on-one with the America in terms of support, in terms of money given to African countries, in terms of resources provided, infrastructural development in Africa. China is playing a bigger role than America would have or should have been playing. So, of course, the American interest in Africa will be looked at in relation to what China is doing in Africa. In Kenya in particular, strategic placement of America vis-a-vis China will be very critical. You remember that our President Ruto was honored and feted in America by Biden. We don't expect it to happen again, but the strategic interests that have been pursued for America in Africa and in Kenya in particular will need to be aggressive so that they can match what China is doing in Africa and in Kenya. That will be one of the key issues that they will need to pull up on.
So we have one candidate, Donald Trump. His foreign policy is going to be America first. Kamala Harris, as you said, might continue the Biden policy of international cooperation when it comes to Africa.
Yeah, of course, the inward-looking policy orientation of Trump, make America first, we will also need to play out if Africa makes it on his table. Remember, he didn't come to Africa in his first presidency. We don't expect that to turn around. And he considers Africa, three quarters of African nation, as third world and developed corrupt countries. So his opinion about Africa will not change drastically. However, in the spirit of making America great, the strategic role China is playing, he might be forced by his handlers to relook at Africa from a different perspective. Of course, Kamala's presidency will be more open. It will be more responsive to issues of internal democracy in Africa and transition politics that are happening in Africa. So Kamala will have a keener look at what is happening in Africa more than Donald Trump.
That's Joseph Kioko, a Kenyan political analyst, speaking with my colleague, James Batty. That's all we prepared for you this Monday, October 28, 2024. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe with the song Zaman Kuru Juja. I've been listening to Emmanuel Kembe and that song Zaman Kuru Juja, which means it's time to go and till your land. For more on our programs, visit www.voa.com. I'm your host John Tanza on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Chang, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While the world still faces security threats from malign states and actors looking to overturn the post-World War II architecture, including terrorism and rogue states looking to expand their territories at their neighbors' expense, the world has changed. Today, we struggle against transnational challenges that respect no boundary, said Richard Verma, Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources. The three main concerns are a global pandemic and its impact, misuse of the enormous advances in technology that can be used to deliberately misinform people, to rob them and even surveil and harass entire populations, and finally, climate change. We have already experienced the first two and have developed new tools to deal with the first two. But climate change is an entirely different matter. The first vector is the impact of climate change on the most vulnerable around the world, those who are already facing poverty or internal civil strife, or those with high exposure, said Deputy Secretary Verma. The intelligence community, in its climate change and national security estimate, predicted that the physical effects of climate change in these countries increase the potential for instability, humanitarian crises, and possible internal conflict. The fact is that climate change could exacerbate cross-border geopolitical flashpoints as countries seek to advance and protect their own interests, said Deputy Secretary Verma. We see this already in the Arctic, where rapid warming is literally changing the political, economic, cultural, and security contours of the Arctic. Then there's the battle over water resources. Nearly 40% of the world's population depends on water that is shared with another country, said Deputy Secretary Verma. We see potential for rising tensions, particularly in river basins, where the rate of change is greater than can be absorbed by local institutions and agreements. Finally, climate change will impact our operational readiness. That is troops and military facilities, embassies and consulates, as well as the global critical infrastructure. Quoting Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, Deputy Secretary Verma said that climate change fundamentally alters the conditions that shape military operations. The Defense Department must adapt to the ways in which extreme weather and climate change affect our readiness and capabilities. The international landscape is complex and often dangerous, said Deputy Secretary Verma. The choices we make today about our most fundamental values will shape the trajectory of our country and global community for generations to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.